thank you for listening to another Hastings NAS podcast. We are so pleased that you have shown interest in listening to this podcast, and we pray that it is edifying and beneficial for you. You can watch us live every Sunday morning on Facebook, facebook.com/HastingsNAS. And if you are so inclined, you can support the ministries of the church by going to hastingsnas.org/give. Hope you enjoy this sermon. Grace and peace.
Did you guys hear, I don't know if you guys saw the headline, this was a couple weeks ago in the news. You hear about the guy whose left side was completely cut off? He got in a real bad accident and the left side of his body was all cut off. He's all right now. buckle up. It's been a minute. Last week, really randomly, we got a knock on our door. There was a police officer who came to our door, and it was really weird. The police officer told me that my dog Aldo had been chasing people on bikes, and I said, "Officer, respectfully, that's ridiculous. He doesn't even own a bike." Can I get one more? I'll tell you one more. I want to tell you about my grandpa. My grandpa was such a great man. Is my mic not on? Can you not hear me very well out there? Pastor Justin just pointed to his ear and walked back there. I got to make sure you hear these. You can't not hear these. is that better? I want to tell you about my grandpa. He was such a good man. He was Grandpa Jack. He was brave. He was strong. He was courageous. He had the heart of a lion and a lifetime ban from the zoo. Justin just explained it to Brody. He leaned over and goes, "Oh, because he took it from the lion at the zoo." And he groaned a little bit. We may groan at puns, but man, puns are such a brilliant form of communication. There's something special about a good pun, isn't there? I love a good pun. I might be alone in this, but man, puns are just the highest form of communication. Nothing higher in our oral or written language. The thing about puns is you gotta be on the inside to get it, don't you? You gotta know something about what's going on in order to bring the groan out of you. You have to have a clear handle on the language, and more often than not, a handle on culturally recognized idioms. You got to know what they're talking about. The pun, "He had the heart of a lion," isn't funny if you're not familiar that in Western civilization, to say that you have the heart of a lion means that you're strong and courageous. If you don't know that, it just sounds silly. The pun receives the reaction it does because the word or phrase has two different meanings, and you need to know both of those meanings for that phrase or that word to land. For the joke to land. And this is why puns don't translate into other languages all that well. Have you ever told a pun to somebody who is not a native English speaker? Bikram, I got to pick on you for just a moment. Bikram is, second language is English, and he's got a perfect handle on the language. He can communicate effectively, so effectively that he's teaching English language in our community and had his first class this week. And Bikram and Ruby had 6 students in their ELL class Thursday night, which is just wonderful, and we celebrate that. But there are moments, I wrote this in my sermon, then I took it out, and I guess it's back in now. There are moments in the office where I love a good pun. I can't help it. They just roll off the tongue. And I'll say something, and Justin will laugh, and Bikram will go, "Huh." Because while you're fluent in English, it's the idioms. It's the idioms in the English language that don't translate into other languages well. And so then it's like, "Oh, here, Bikram, that's funny. Here, let me explain to you why that's funny." And when you have to explain why it's funny, it's really not that funny. But if you aren't in on the meaning, you just sound weird. And sometimes when you are in on the meaning, you just sound weird. And while puns are almost always a form of comedy in our culture, I would add the highest form of comedy There are pun competitions, by the way. If you want to go on online on YouTube and watch pun competitions, they're actual competitions. In antiquity, and in our passage today, there is a pun. Only the pun is not comedic. In our language, puns are funny. They're hilarious. They bring out groans of laughter. But that's not the only ways that puns can get used literarily. And there's a pun in our text today, at least one, that John is intentional about incorporating. And it's a very serious pun. And if I can dangle something in front of you, there's another pun in our reading next week. This week's sermon is titled Punny Faith Part 1. Can you guess what next week's is going to be called? Oh, who'd have thought? In fact, the gospel writer, John, uses puns quite a lot in his text. It's one of his literary devices. It's one of the unique characteristics about the gospel of John. And as I said before, the thing about puns is that unless you have a handle on the language, chances are you're going to miss out on the pun. Chances are you're not going to get it. So let me ask you, of everyone here today, how many of us are fluent in Koine Greek? Anyone here? Anyone fluent in ancient Greek? No? No one? Nope. I've taken 2 semesters of it, and that was more than enough for me. So if you have to understand the language and the culture in order to appreciate a pun, let me ask you, how likely is it that you and I, who are not fluent in this ancient language and are reading a text translated into another language, how likely is it that we're going to pick up on a pun? Not very likely. Like 1 in 100? More like 1 in 1,000,000. So you're telling me there's a chance. Well, I want to help us out a little bit because John's puns are theological. They're not comedic. They're not funny. They are theological. They're revelatory. They tell us about who Jesus is and how Jesus works. And as we've established, puns have required 2 different meanings for them to work. So for us to grasp the puns in John's gospel, let me do a little bit of foundational work. Bear with me for just a moment in order for us to understand what's happening here. To do this, we need to know about Jewish cosmology. First century Jewish cosmology. Let me briefly explain how first century Jews understood the order of the cosmos, the order of the world, the heavens and the earth and everything in between. Ancient Jews believed that there were 2 spheres, well, 3 spheres, but 2 spheres, the sphere of the heavens, which was quite literally seated above the world. Then there was the sphere of the world, which is where we all dwell. There was a 3rd sphere, which was the sphere beneath the earth, Sheol, the pit, the place of the dead, and it was seated literally beneath us. But for our purposes today, we're operating on the first 2 planes or spheres, the sphere of heaven, the plane of heaven, and the plane of earth. The sphere of the heavens, the heavenly plane, was the dwelling place of divinity. That's where God dwelt. It was where the angels were. It was full of goodness, and its defining characteristic was light. It was holy, and it was whole. It was complete. But then there was the sphere of the world, the plane of our earthly existence. That was the dwelling place, not of God. That was the dwelling place instead of humans. And it was broken. It was full of evil, and its defining characteristic was darkness. It was unholy and broken. We see these 2 spheres in Jesus' words in the gospel reading. This is the imagination of these people at this time. Jesus said to Nicodemus, "If I have told you about earthly things and you do not believe, how can you believe if I tell you about heavenly things?" These are the 2 planes of existence, which rarely, if ever, interact. The 2 Jewish spheres, the heavenly and the earthly. We see sometimes that the chasm between these spheres is bridged. Think of Jacob's ladder, where the heavens were opened and angels were ascending and descending. And if we don't operate within this cosmology, if we don't operate within this understanding of how the world is ordered, and spoiler alert, as Western 21st century people, that's not how we understand the world to work. That if we don't, then the pun of this passage might be easy to miss. And I think that for a lot of reasons, we've missed it by and large. See, when Jesus is met by Nicodemus, we know, John tells us, that this conversation is going to take place on the sphere of the world. That Nick isn't going to get it. We know that this is going to happen, because when does Nicodemus come to Jesus? First verse, John chapter 3, says Nicodemus came to Jesus at night. Oh, a good sermon title would be Nick at Night. I just thought of that. 3 years from now, when this passage comes back, somebody better tell me, Nick at Night. You'll remember it now. Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night in the dark. Another spoiler for next week for Punny Faith Part 2. Jesus will meet someone else at a different time of day with a different amount of light in that conversation. And that will indicate on what plane or what sphere that conversation takes place. Okay, that's a lot of groundwork. You ready for the pun? Have I built up the anxiety enough? You ready to hear the pun of John chapter 3? Jesus tells Nicodemus he must be born anothen. Hey, Zach, can you turn just my mic down a little bit? He says, you must be born anothen in Koine Greek. Anothen is a pun in the original language. Not a joke, a serious one, because the word anothen has two meanings. It can mean two different things in the original language. It can mean either again, or it can mean, as you maybe heard from when I read it this morning from the New Revised Standard Version, to be born from above. Anothen means two things. It means again, or it means from above. That word has two meanings. And if you have a problem with words having two meanings, don't learn English. You see, within the first century Jewish cosmology, one definition operates on the worldly plane and the other definition operates on the heavenly plane. And shocker, Nick doesn't get it. He doesn't catch the pun. He misunderstands that Jesus is not speaking about the earthly plane. He asks Jesus, how can a grown man enter again into his mother's womb? It's just that Jesus isn't talking about being born again. Jesus doesn't say you must be born again. He's saying you're not born again. You're born from above. Or maybe being born from heaven. A new birth, not from this plane, but from the plane of God's dwelling. You catch that? Jesus isn't saying that Nick needs to be born again. Jesus is saying that Nick needs to be born from above. And I think whenever we've talked for the last 100 years or so about being born again, that's what we mean. To be born again is not to enter your mother's womb a second time, right? It is recognizing what Jesus meant here, to be born from above. And church, I don't know if you can catch this or not, but this is a really bold thing for Jesus to do. Like, this is a really kind of problematic thing for Jesus to do. Especially in a culture that has a high differential for authority. We live in a culture with a very low differential for authority. Just because you're an elected person, just because you have a title, just because you have an office, doesn't mean you're going to get respect. We don't respect the office very much. The person is respected if that respect is earned. In this culture, you respect the office. Doesn't matter who sits in the office. You have respect for that person because they're in that place. So what Jesus does here is kind of shocking. Nicodemus, a leader of the Jews. What this means is that Nicodemus was a leader among the Pharisees, a leader among the Judeans, those who kept the law. This was a leader of the leaders. Let me see if I can draw a comparison for our religious system today, something comparable in our world today, and I'll use Nazarene vernacular because I just had a membership class this morning and it's fun to talk about. Jesus telling Nicodemus that he must be born from heaven, and Jesus telling Nick that he does not understand what he is saying, would be like someone with a local pastor's license, not ordained, no formal theological education, telling a general superintendent, a clergy person who's been ordained for decades, with a PhD in historical or systematic theology, telling them that they need to start over and that they do not understand the things of heaven. Yeah, this system you've dedicated your entire existence to, start over. You need a rebirth. And when pushed back, Jesus says, how are you going to get it? You're so stuck into this system, there's no way for you to get it, man. I mean, this is scandalous. This is scandalous. He is telling someone of the highest status possible that he's worldly. Someone with a local license tells the general superintendent of the Church of the Nazarene, oh, brother, sister, you got to start over. You don't get it. You don't get it. You're too worldly. You don't understand the things of heaven. I mean, that's a big deal. That is a big deal. An itinerant preacher from Galilee, from Nazareth, telling Nicodemus, a Pharisee, a leader of the Pharisees, that he needs to start over. And I gotta wonder, church, if that's not what Jesus says to people today. Maybe people who aren't, maybe not people who are at the highest status of some religious system. Maybe Jesus says that also today to people who've been in the faith for a long time. Maybe people who believe what they believe. Maybe people who are pretty solid in their religious convictions. Jesus invited Nicodemus to think differently about his faith. And Jesus challenged not only his religious system, Jesus challenged his lifelong held convictions. And also probably challenged his economic status. So when was the last time you felt like Jesus was challenging your convictions? When was the last time you felt like Jesus was asking you to think differently about your faith? When was the last time you felt Jesus was saying that you need to open your heart to a bigger gospel than the gospel you've known? Because I don't know about you, but Jesus tends to solidify my convictions, not change them. Jesus tends to reinforce what I believe, rather than throw it out. When was the last time Jesus told you to start over? You need a new birth. Because that's what he's doing. If Jesus says that to Nicodemus, does he say it to me? Can this old dog learn some new tricks? Because that's what Jesus is doing. Nicodemus, you see, Nicodemus, he was a part of a system, not just a part of a system, a leader of the Jews who made all of these rules and regulations. When we talk about the Jews here, we need to qualify that this is the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem, the Judeans, the religious and cult leaders of Jerusalem. This is not painting the entire faith in one generalization. This, and John is talking about a specific group of people from Jerusalem, the Judeans. But Jesus is saying to Nicodemus that he's a part of the system that made all of these rules and regulations about what it means to be faithful. Hey, you've said it's all this and all that. And do you know what Jesus says to him? Hey, I invite you to forget all that. Isn't that kind of scary? You see, Nick had all of these stipulations on what it meant to be saved, on what it meant to be righteous. You can't do this on this day. You can't do this on this day. And if you're going to do this, you have to do it on that day. You have to eat this. You can't eat that. And you got to cut that off. You have to look like this and dress like this and walk like this. Do you know what Jesus says to this leader of the religious in Jerusalem? Jesus says to him, that's not what it looks like. That's not what it's about. Jesus says salvation is when is Moses holding up the serpent in the wilderness. Maybe this is another pun that you need to know a little bit of the context to understand. You remember when Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness? When the Israelites were dying from being bitten by poisonous snakes because of their unfaithfulness, Moses made a bronze snake. He hoisted it up onto a staff. And whenever anybody got bit by a snake, what did they do? They would look at it, and they were healed. Did you know that that's why the symbol for medicine is a staff with at least one or two snakes coiling up it? Jesus says to Nicodemus, hey, the Son of Man's going to be lifted up like the serpent in the wilderness. What is Christ's being lifted up? What is the exaltation of Jesus? What is it but his crucifixion? The Son of Man too will be lifted up that will bring healing to the nations. And what will it be but his death? And what will it be but his resurrection? And what will it be but his ascension? Where a humanly one will be in that heavenly place. You see, Jesus is lifted up. And what Jesus is saying is this. Like that serpent, I bring salvation through my own death, through my resurrection and through my ascension, through my being lifted up. I am salvation. And guess what, Nick? It's available to anybody who will look at it. Did you catch that? The Son of Man will be lifted up like the serpent in the wilderness. Who was healed in the wilderness? Anyone who was sick. Full stop. Like the Israelites in the wilderness, all people need to do is look to Christ on the cross for salvation. No performance of rituals. No having all of your ducks in a row. No righteousness preceding acceptance. They don't need to have all righteousness or look all righteous. What do they need? They need to know they're sick. They need to know that they are in need. They need to know that they can't save themselves. And do you know who's turned away from this salvation? Well, if we keep reading in the Gospel of John chapter 3, it tells us who's condemned. Those who are condemned are the ones who've condemned themselves already. If you keep reading John 3, 18 through 21, it says, who is it that is condemned but those who condemn themselves already? Who is it but those who refuse to believe? Who are turned away from this salvation? No one that looks to Christ is turned away. Only those who refuse bring that judgment upon themselves. Everyone who knows they're sick and in need of salvation, like that serpent in the wilderness, is made whole. Every single one. Everyone who has sin in their life and know they can't do anything to save themselves but need Jesus to do something to be saved. No ifs, ands, or buts. You can be saved if, no if. You can be saved, but you need no buts. No one who knows that they have sin is turned away. The only ones who are turned away are the ones who turn themselves away. Read John 3, 18 through 21. Jesus says to Nick at night that all are welcome to look to him for healing. Let me ask you, does all mean all? Does the word all mean all? I wonder if we believe that. After all, the Son of Man came not to condemn the world, but to save it. That is, the Son of Man came not to point out how everyone keeps missing the mark. Look at all this sin of this world. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. The Son of Man came not to keep people out. Well, you can only worship with us if you look like this and if you act like this. The Son of Man came not to look with disapproval over people. The Son of Man came not to condemn the world. Sometimes I wish John 3:17 had been the verse everybody memorized instead of John 3:16. If Jesus came and said that he doesn't condemn the world, who do you think you can condemn? Who can I condemn? Who can we, the church, condemn? Who do we have permission to say, you are not welcome, you do not belong, there's no place for you here? Who do you think you can look on with disapproval? As if I have something within myself that makes me approved. As if I'm not sick myself and needing to look up to Christ on the cross myself. I'll be honest, church. I am so blown away by how frequently the church stands against the world. Christ assumed a posture towards the world, which, given his understanding of cosmology as a good first century Jew, makes no sense. The world is the place of darkness and brokenness and sin. And Jesus said, hey, I came not to condemn that place of brokenness and darkness and sin. I'm not condemning it. I want to redeem it. I want to make it whole. I want to unite it with heaven. So I'm blown away that our text that is so familiar to us, that says this is Jesus' posture to the world, stands over against the world. Let me say, I'm not surprised that the world stands against the church. I'm not surprised if the world is antagonistic towards the church, because the world can do what the world will do. I have no jurisdiction there. No, I'm surprised by how frequently the church goes to war with the world. How many wars can we wage? We want to fight the worship wars. We want to fight the culture wars. We want to win the culture wars at all costs. We are the community that confessed the very presence of the one who was lifted up. Lifted up, he said, so that everyone may have life to the full. So we say, we are the people that were established by the one who said that everyone was welcome and only those who excluded themselves aren't welcome. And yet, it is Lent after all. After all, can we confess? And yet, how frequently is the public posture of the church towards the world one that does not reflect the one who we profess to be representing? How frequently is our posture toward the world contrary to what Jesus said his posture toward the world was? How do we relate to our world? I don't know. If Jesus said he wasn't condemning the world, who do we have permission to condemn? What people group, what community, what organization, what individual? See, church, today I want to close the message with an invitation. And if I'm honest, I don't think the invitation is coming from me. In fact, the invitation might as just as much be for me. You see, I believe the invitation today comes from Jesus himself. I think Jesus is inviting you and I and us with Nicodemus. I think Jesus is inviting us to be born from above. We who have been a part of this faith for so long, we who are set in our ways, we who know how things work, we who've got it figured out, we old dogs who struggle to learn new tricks. I believe Jesus is inviting us, the religious, to be born from above, to reimagine the way that Christ interacts with this world. An invitation to reimagine how we interact with our world. Jesus is inviting us to start over, to see with new eyes. Jesus is inviting us to leave behind the ways in which we legislate righteousness. Maybe Jesus is even inviting us, we who've been a part of this religious system for so long, to recognize that we too are sick and in need of healing. Maybe Jesus is inviting us to stop looking left or right at how righteous or unrighteous our neighbors are or aren't, and instead to look to Christ on the cross, like the serpent in the wilderness. What if we knew we were in such great need that we could not take our eyes off of Christ on the cross to look at our neighbors to see if they're going to hell or heaven? What if we were so concerned that we were so aware of our own sin that we felt like we couldn't point it out in others? If the Apostle Paul can say, I'm the chief of sinners, who am I to say I'm not? Jesus is inviting us to simply look to him. After all, Christ came not to condemn the world, so maybe we shouldn't condemn others either. This is the good news of Jesus Christ for us and for the world today.